at Scott on 21st October. Is that right? Yeah.
That's
right. I
think
it is. 1994. Say that in case this is transcribed by somebody 20 years from now. At the magnificent palatial studio of KPFA in Berkeley. And I'd like to start out in what has... Oops, I haven't got this on me. That's why it doesn't matter. Thank heavens this isn't for broadcast, only for transcription. So I'll start off with what has proved to be a productive first question, which is, how did you first become involved with KPFA and Pacifica?
Well, there's a story, probably like a lot of other stories that you've heard. I was the assistant to the mayor in Berkeley, deputy mayor in Berkeley for during the early 80s. And
Newport?
I was working with Gus. Gus and I were partners in crime in the city of Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And Peter Frank, who was then the president of Pacifica, and Jane Hunter came to me, and I talked to Gus to talk about the fact that Pacifica was going to accept corporate underwriting. And I was a bit appalled because I have a Master of Fine Arts in theater and television from UCLA, and I used to come as an exchange student from UCLA to KQED when there was Newsroom. And so I was really appalled when they got rid of Newsroom and sort of attributed it to the fact that there was so much corporate underwriting at KQED that they could no longer really afford to do local programming. So I had a real stick up my butt about corporate underwriting. And so I jumped on the bandwagon, got Gus on the bandwagon, and he and I went down to San Luis Obispo and signed on to this letter written by Peter Frank and a lot of dissidents in Pacifica, including Mark Cooper from KPFK in Los Angeles and a lot of other folks. Claire Sparks, and we signed this letter condemning Pacifica for considering taking corporate underwriting. About 2 weeks later, David Solniker and Ying Lee Kelly, who was my neighbor, lived down the street from me, and I had a lot of respect for, who was an aide to Ron Dillums, and was also working on the Jesse Jackson campaign with me. They came into my office and said, and this Mariah Gillard, and this woman who's been taken off the air, was one of the first people that I fired when I became manager at KPFA. The three of them came into my office and said, you know, you're really way out of order. You don't know what's going on, and we're appalled that you and Gus have signed this letter, and sat down to read me the Riot Act and give me some history about what was going on. And I listened to them and believed what they said, I didn't know David and Mariah, but I knew Ying Kelly and respected her opinion and knew that whatever she was saying was the truth, quite frankly. So I agreed to take my name off the letter and ask Gus to take his off the letter, which we did. About 2 weeks later, I got a call from David Solniker asking me if I would be on the board of KPFA. So I ended up being on the board of KPFA.
Sometimes you get advancement by signing things. Other years, sometimes you get advancement by unsigning.
So Dick Bunce and I joined the board of KPFA around the same time. And around that very same time, David was putting forth an idea about development and a capital campaign. And I was really bored with going to the KPFA advisory board meetings and would sleep halfway through them on the floor. Mm-hmm. And once he started talking about capital campaigns and development and a new building, then I got involved. Mm-hmm. Like, I was really involved at that point. And the job of manager came open, and I was looking for somebody to do it. I never worked for those kinds of wages. I hadn't worked for those kinds of wages in a long time, let's say that. It was even less money than I made when I was teaching elementary school. So I hadn't
Your cat came off of chicken livers at that point.
Oh, God. So I was, Toni Morrison, the author Toni Morrison, was in town, and mm-hmm. there were a bunch of African-American women that were having a party for Toni. And so I went. It was at Angela Davis's house. And I was talking about with the women that I knew that I had worked in different political alliances of one kind or another over the past couple of decades. I started talking to them about it. And they said, Pat, your daughter's grown. What are you talking about? You can do this job. You should apply for it, right? So that's how I thought about it for another week and actually applied for the job. But I had no intention of being a manager at KPFA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's... plus les change, as they say. A history of people who didn't intend to do the job. Who was it? Was the presidential campaign? If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. Yeah, and of course he did both. But. Yeah. Anyway, so you came in at a time when you knew that there was going to be a great fundraising campaign to put KPFA into new quarters.
That's right. I mean, it was essentially developed by David Solnicker and Dick Bunce and myself, and we ended up being the trio.
Excuse me. Ah, God. I'm allergic to interviews. Sorry. Yeah. Go on.
We ended up being the trio. We worked together. It was none of us, none of the three of us could have done it without the other, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have, the three of us have a lot of respect for each other. We work well together, mm-hmm. and it worked.
They talk about a triumvirate in the early days of KPFA with Lou Hill and Dick Moore.
This is the latter day.
And Virginia McKenna. Yeah, you're the new triumvirate.
Yeah.
Did you get... this is almost a comic question. Did you get resistance at the idea of moving into a new building?
There was a lot of resistance. People, the whole idea, and there's virtue in poverty, essentially, that permeated the organization. People that worked in the organization, though, the paid staff and unpaid staff that were there on a regular basis, really... Mm-hmm. I think for the most part really appreciated the idea of moving out of the place. I mean, essentially in the wintertime, you know, we sat there with gloves with holes on our fingers and down jackets. There was no way to work comfortably. And in the summer it was burning up hot, so there was no hot water. I was, the first day I came to work in the place, I was a little appalled at the filth. I couldn't believe it. I mean, the first week, what I did was call the city dumpster and plan to move all the junk and garbage. There were sofas in the hallway with dead mice in them. And I couldn't breathe, you know. I was sneezing all the time. It was so mm-hmm. filthy in the place. It was like, I had white pants on and walked out to have lunch, and I looked down, and I had these little spots. I had fleas all over me. And so, you know, there was no way I was dealing with that. So at that point, I started putting things on a real serious fast track because mm-hmm. I couldn't stand it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You bring back vivid memories. It's, I was through years of that in the early 60s, mm-hmm. and it wasn't particularly different then. I think it was probably a little less dirty then because the hippie syndrome hadn't really entered in at that point, and there was not the positive virtue in filth, certain monastic orders that the dirtier they are, the holier they are.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Anyway, it was a little difficult because people wanted to, you know, it's a very democratic organization, and people wanted to participate very thoroughly in the planning. And so early on, Denny Abrams, whose firm was chosen to design and build this mm-hmm. place, had this idea about... an environment that was conducive to the kind of work that you were doing. And so he essentially said, look, we have to include everybody. Let's talk to them. But everybody needs to understand at the outset that we're taking in their comments, their suggestions, and then we're going to take a look at that, and we're going to come back to them with what we what we're going to do, and then take more comments and suggestions. And so we had lots of meetings. We met with individual people, particularly Denny Abrams and Rick Milliken, and their the architect that was on staff with them at the time, David Trachtenberg. And they are, for the most part, the three of them, liberal, socially active, but also very much involved in the economic scheme of things in mm-hmm. the community mm-hmm. yeah. And involved in development, in community development.
Yeah, that lovely block down on 4th Street.
That's right. That's Denny.
Yeah, having eaten three times at Oshame.
Oh, it's wonderful.
In a week.
That's wonderful, yeah. So, you know, and so that's how the staff participated. And people were really very cooperative. A lot of people felt that they did not have enough input into it. But I think for the most part, people felt that they did. The engineers, particularly the operations manager at KPFA, was not happy about this room and that window and a lot mm-hmm. of other things, but we had to make some decisions about mm-hmm. technical space and office space, and so everybody mm-hmm. wasn't happy about it, but we tried to come
yes.
up with it.
Yeah. Yeah, Marcy said that if she were involved in something all over again, she would pay a bit more attention to soundproofing between rooms.
We did the most we could with the money we had. It was a conscious decision as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't trying to build a sound studio. It's a radio station, a community radio station. And so weighing everything, we just made decisions about how to do it with the money that we had. And so this is what we got.
Yeah. I mean, if you get into real soundproofing, you get into suspension on rubber blocks and stuff.
And that's what we were looking at.
It eats up money at an yeah. incredible rate.
Yeah. And so, you know, I hired an acoustics engineer. He did a lot of work pro bono for us, Red Weatherill. And he put the facts on the table. He says, this is what this will buy you, this is what this will buy you, and this is what this will buy you. And you have to make a decision about what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you buy the top of the line, you will not be able to afford to do anything else.
Yeah, you'll have a soundproof studio with no sounds in it.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we had already made a decision about we really optimally needed more space because we needed space for community people to come in and work and for staff and volunteers. And we had the original design of the building had included a mezzanine. And it was real hard for me to get rid of that. But that decision had to be made as well. You know, you couldn't have this fancy building and have to lay off staff. And that's mm-hmm. really what we were looking at doing, finally, if we had done that. So so it was conservative to do this. And the backup for it was essentially the two stores next door, one which was eventually turned over to Youth Radio, mm-hmm. and the other which has a restaurant in it and has a finite lease, which we could eventually take over as well.
Uh-huh. So you can expand sideways.
That's right.
At some future date.
Mm-hmm. But this was the best we could do here under the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Well, from what I had a long talk, as you know, with David yesterday, and appeared from that was that the KPFA is not only on better financial footing than it has ever been before, but also on better financial footing than the other stations.
Always better than the other stations. Though I'm a little afraid now because I think that Pacifica and KPFA have not responded as quickly to an audience that's available as they really need to. And it's really very evident in this last marathon where KPFA did not make their marathon goals. They usually do within a few $1,000s.
Mm-hmm.
And they have really maxed out on the number of people that support the organization, support what they do, that give so much money. And what we really have to be clearly doing right now is finding new audiences. You know, my position is essentially that if our mission is to influence people, then we need to have an audience that hears what we're doing. And so in order to broaden that audience in a very sophisticated media world, we really have to improve the technical quality of our broadcast as well as make what we're doing accessible to a larger number of people. So that's mm-hmm. that's what we're doing now.
Yeah. One of the things that you're up against, I think, is that, I don't need to tell you, you've been studying it, that the nature of who an audience are and has changed a lot.
That's right.
on FM. And the people who, in the early days of KPFA, used to be glued to their sets as their lifeline to certain kinds of information
right.
that
well,
were not accessible in any other way, now are at the prime time slots are more likely to be glued to their televisions than to their radios, for instance.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think that there. I just read a report that radio listening is the number of people listening to radio is increasing. I just read mm-hmm. that this afternoon after I was not here when you came.
Well, I hope that turns out to be more reliable than the reports that drinking red wine is good for it.
But what happens, I think, is that there is. I think that National Public Radio has a very, very large audience. And it's while it is not as politic as some of the things that Pacifica stations tend to do, they do cover issues of interest to our audience. It's accessible, and it's easy to listen to. And so it's easier to listen to sort of a lesser political quality but covering a whole lot more issues that NPR offers than it is to listen to Pacifica, which is hit and miss a lot of times because we're depending on volunteers as well as some seriously overworked paid staff.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that we produce is not that accessible mm-hmm. to people. People never know when they're going to get it.
I've got to tell you, well, I haven't got to, but I'm going to, that the first day that I came here on this trip, and I got to the place where I'm staying, I went to and turned on the FM to 94.1. And I had about half an hour to spare. And the first thing I heard was about 10, 12 minutes of some of the most embarrassing plugging on the air that I had heard in all the years that I'd been around, and I heard a lot of it,
mm-hmm.
And it pushed all the buttons of antagonism and inferiority at the same time, and I stayed glued with my teeth gritted, and then came on a 15-minute approximately spot on the Pacifica News Network from Mexico, which was one of the best summaries of what was going on in Mexico in alternative politics down there that I have heard anywhere, and I've been following this not like a professional in London, but with a certain amount of tension mm-hmm. in the Guardian and other papers that reported, you know, particularly at the time of the armed uprising in the South when everybody it was fashionable and
yeah.
Flavor of the month and everybody was writing about it. But there, in the course of these 15 minutes, was a very reasoned and clear
report.
With interviews, with overdubs, all very professionally handled,
right.
And no zing-zang production values that got in the way and distracted you. I just sat there and turned my brain on and listened hard,
right.
And it was good.
Right. It's very exciting. You know, it's like the little girl with the curl in the middle of her forehead. When it's good, it's very, very good. And when it's bad, it's just hard.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And so, you know, I think there's a real move in this organization, which I support and which I'd like to help move along, you know, to really do something about that, to really take what's good and develop it and throw all the horrid stuff away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, my wife writes, and this is not is going to prove not to be totally irrelevant. My wife writes about on the subject of healthy food for young children,
mm-hmm.
and she's written one book and is in the process of another. And in the course of her research and the research that has been reported to her into nursery schools and also into old people's homes. What always proved to be the case was that they were either absolutely marvelous or they were utterly dreadful. Mm-hmm. There was practically nothing in between. Yeah. And if they were good, someone came in from outside and soon they were good as well. Mm-hmm. If they were bad, a marvelous person came in a short period of time it just sort of deteriorated into the general level of glop.
Well, let me give you an example of how it works in Pacifica. You know, we've had a real hard time at WPFW in Washington where the manager was fired and to go in and put a whole new management team together there. Well, the woman that's there who's the National Program Director, Gail Christian, is a bit of a character. And she's one that you love or you hate, and she's very, very funny. And she's also a very serious pragmatist. And so she's come in, and she's, like, done all these things, and now we've got people clamoring to come to the station. We've been having a hard time finding a development director. Nobody wants to be associated with Pacifica's WPFW. And now, within the period of 2 months, I've got two of the top development directors around calling to see if we're interested in hiring them as development directors at WPFW. So, you know, we're really excited. Success really brings the people that will make it more successful. And so we're looking at sort of building on what some of our successes are. And it's a lot of fun. It's really exciting, you know, mm-hmm. to really have yeah. that happen because we were really afraid of what would happen at WPFW to the point that we thought we might even lose the station. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's got to be in better shape than the mayoralty campaign.
Well, you know, there's a lot of support for amongst African-American people for Marion Barry, quite frankly. You know, I get off an airplane and go into WPFW, and you talk to the taxi cab drivers. And they say, you know, we know he's got problems, but he's our problem, and we're voting for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have very clear memories in Massachusetts, where I grew up.
Where?
Cape Cod. Uh-huh. I'm a Provincetown boy.
Oh, come on. You can grow up in Provincetown. Yeah. I spent some of my vacation in Wellesley.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was born in Chatham and then grew up in Provincetown.
Wow.
And I was just back there at the beginning of this trip for a couple of days. Yeah. I won't go into that. That'd take the rest of the afternoon. You'd be listening to me. But where was I? Oh, yes. Growing up there, I have distinct memories of the Boston Irish and Mayor Curley being elected back in again while he was serving a jail sentence.
That's right. It's the same deal.
Yeah.
It's the same
uh-huh.
deal.
Yeah. I mean, and if the language had been the same in those days, they would have said the same thing. He's a problem, but he's our problem.
That's exactly right. And so that's how he got mm-hmm. elected again. Mm-hmm. And when I told Dick, I said, Dick and David, when I were having lunch, I said, you mark my word, Marion's going to be the mayor again. They said, oh, no, no way. I said, you watch. Mm-hmm. Sure mm-hmm. was. And he actually did some good things. He did a lot of good things in Washington. People remember it, you know, mm-hmm. before he slid down into the abyss. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not sure what he'll do this time, but he sure got a whole lot of people backing him.
Well, it has always been the case that any spokesperson for any kind of a previously suppressed minority group, there's an enormous temptation to become an arrogant sort of figure, mm-hmm. Showing off on behalf of everybody else.
Right.
I mean, Huey Long, for God's sake.
Oh, is that
behalf
a perfect of, example?
Behalf of the redneck.
That's right.
And you know, color isn't in it.
Uh-uh.
Well, now, I want to ask you about what effects have you found that the new premises have had on programming, aside from things just being easier?
Well, I think what it does is it provides access for a different cadre of people. I think that prior to this building being open and accessible to just a vast array of people, mm-hmm. okay. what had happened is that
Could you just stick it up about 4 inches? Because it's turned out to be down where you want to cross your arms.
Only people that had their own equipment, you know, that could afford their own equipment and studio time elsewhere, could really afford to do really nice productions.
The captain of the team is the boy that owns the baseball.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I was I always looked at it as providing a space for community people to be able to come in and produce, those that were interested in the technical aspect of it and the social aspect of it, to be able to come into these studios and work with some help and eventually learn how to do it themselves. So I forgot about that, actually. And I got the electric bills, the PG&E bills, and I said, damn. I said, there should be a lot less here than they were in the other place. Well, it occurred to me after about 3 or 4 weeks coming in here, because I would get called at home when the alarms went off, and mm-hmm. sometimes I'd come in here to get people, because I wasn't allowing any sleeping in here, to rouse mm-hmm. people out of their sleeping habitats. And so I'd come in here just sort of spot checks, 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, and people would be in here working.
Mm-hmm.
Coming here on the weekend, people would be in here working. And so, you know,
I remember reading you on this subject of seeing all those lights. What are those lights on? And you find out that it's actually...
You know, I live right around the corner, so what would happen is that I would, like, pass by here coming home from the movies or coming home from somewhere, and I'd see all these lights on, and I'd come in here, and there we are. You know, people would be in here working. So I think it's really had a good effect on being available to certain people in the community. I think we really have not done a good job of really assessing other communities. I mean, if you know about it and you're a part of the apprenticeship training program or you're a part of some kind of political group, you know, that has access to somebody that's already in the station, then you can come in and do it. But to have, let's say if you're a doctor in town and you really want to talk about some of the health issues around, there really isn't a vehicle whereby you could come in and do that, and there really should be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one of the things that Marcy was telling me about was the intention to get a portable digital...
KU band, KU uplink, portable uplink, mm-hmm. so you can go out. But we also should be a lot more open, I think, if our staff was arranged a little bit differently, so that instead of department heads the way it's set up now, if people were actually producers, you know, that it would help, because the general public are not radio people. They don't want to be radio mm-hmm. people, but they do want to get their issues out. And mm-hmm. if there was a vehicle by which you could do that, I think it would be a lot more successful.
One of the things that you must be faced with, because I detect that you have a strong, I call it a bias, in favor of good production values and professional sound on the air, is that... That those who have legitimate grievances and a right to be heard are not always synonymous with the people who, going on the air, will actually have something to say to enough people to justify their being there.
But see, so, I don't think that's true. I think that if people are produced. If you set up a situation whereby somebody comes in off the street and they want to complain about whatever it is and they want to, like, have their issue heard, mm-hmm. if somebody professional is in this radio station that can set it up so that they can be produced, can, like, organize it so that their thoughts are coherent, they can be heard, and it's organized, I think that it's possible to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I really think it's possible mm-hmm. to do that.
But that implies a production. One has to call it authority figure, who makes some decisions about what is said and what is done.
Well, I suppose so, but I think that that's a larger decision that staff needs to make. I mean, I think we have a lot of socially conscious people on staff. There is a program council, and those decisions can be made in that larger body. They don't have to be left to an individual to make.
Mm-hmm. One thing which I sense, and I haven't been around long enough to, you know, say this with authority, is that perhaps a tendency for an increasing sense of coalition among minority interests compared to what was happening a few years ago when there seemed to be a tendency for minority representation sometimes to be at each other's throat fighting for airtime.
Well, I think that, well, I don't actually think that's happened. I would like to see that happen, quite frankly. I think that one of the things that we've sort of like failed to do, I'm talking about the left so-called progressive community, is to really sit down and let's agree to go on issues that we can agree on and that we can work on together and agree to disagree on the other stuff, you know, and just move ahead, because I don't think any of us gets anywhere unless we really form coalitions, and I really believe in coalition politics as well as coalitions in the radio station.
Because one thing which was true in the 1960s for a while, whatever one has to say about what ultimately happened, but it was the case that there were a large number of oppressed minorities who saw common cause in each other, and one did have Jews and WASPs and blacks all working together down there in the South on the civil rights movement, and there was a sense that that the enemy was not each other but those people out there and up there who had created a social and economic and political environment that was untenable.
Well, I think that still exists today to a large extent. It's sometimes real hard to see, but I think it does exist. At KPFA and in Pacifica, I think that sometimes things tend to be still real separated. For instance, at KPFA, there is a Third World Department, which tends to be the African-American department, and sometimes a few Asians thrown here in here and there. And then the assistant public affairs, co-public affairs director is a Latino, and the Latinos go to that department. So it still is very polarized. Mm-hmm. And there is, there are big questions here about doing programming in Spanish, which I've always been opposed to because I think it's not accessible to a larger group of people. Mm-hmm. And there are real fights about issues like that. And they tend to be very polarized. And one of the things that happens in this organization, instead of like sitting down and brainstorming and talking about how to deal with it, people don't talk about it because they don't want so-and-so to get mad, and they don't want to cause any uproar. So a lot of issues get brushed under the table here because nobody wants to talk about it until it really comes out in the open. And then there's a big fight about it and a big flare-up.
Yeah. Well, these things inevitably happen, and we both know that that a large part of the history of KPFA has been a history of internecine warfare. Yeah. Out there on the floor with blood all over the place.
Now I'm not sure it's any healthier, quite frankly. I mean, you don't have blood all over the place unless you really raise the issues publicly. Which I tend to do, as I'm sure you will.
Yeah. Well, I've been in and out and hanging around for the last few days, and I must say one of the things that impresses me compared with what I very well remember is how quiet and orderly and well greased and efficient everything appears. And I've been around enough to know when that's happening and when it isn't, and it really, compared with most organizations, all of which have their inefficiencies, it seems to work on pretty well-oiled machinery.
Well, it actually does work on pretty well-oiled machinery, but there are a lot of things going on underneath, and people want peace. They want peace, especially after their last fight with me. They want, they want a period of stability. But what happens is that all of these things simmer, And then they'll sort of erupt like a volcano at a certain period of time. It sort of tends to happen every 5 or 10 years, and all of it comes up.
Yeah, well, I've had reports from time to time from an old and dear friend, Eric Barsfeld, who's been around for a long time. Yeah. I was his technical producer for Black Mass back there, and did all those things. Yeah. So we've been close for a long time. And Eric is somebody whose perspicacity I have a lot of respect for. He has commented to me that there was a time not so many years ago when everything was in a total and perpetual state of chaos, and personal relations around the station were constantly nasty.
Yeah, they were. I had never seen such an act when I came here. I'd never seen people treat each other like that before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he says, now, not as a profound judgment on colossal sea change of the of nature's place, but that, in a word, he says, people are nice.
Yeah, they're nice, and I think it has real advantages. Mm-hmm. But I think at the same time, it should not gloss over what some of the real issues are, and I think that people can be nice to each other and still discuss the issues that are of concern to them.
Yeah.
And what I think happens here now is people tend not to do it anymore, which I think is very sad.
Yeah, it's too bad. Come, let us reason together is still not the worst advice in the world.
No, that's right. But, you know, it's not just like I'm at KPFA most often and have more experience at KPFA than the rest of the Pacifica stations. KPFA, I think, is probably peaceful. KPFT is peaceful, and WPFW now is peaceful with Gail being there. But WBAI and KPFK are not, quite frankly. They're not. And they tend not to have as good programming, good meaning it's not as accessible. It's not as technically proficient. The programming is not accessible in terms of you can turn on at 2 o'clock and find sort of like something, you know, similar across Monday through Friday. And they tend to be in the most economic trouble. So it's, you know, something, whatever is to be said about that.
Yeah, I had a great session with Larry Bensky this morning.
Yeah.
Which went on for almost 3 hours.
Oh, Larry loves to talk.
Yeah. And he's even capable of listening as well.
I know. That dog over there at Larry's house is my dog.
I only heard it in the background. I didn't actually see it.
Yeah,
I only got introduced to the cat.
Yeah.
But now Larry to me is an example of what I would call the phrase of E.E. Cummings comes to mind, delectable mountains. Those people of enormous talent and dedication and intellect and everything. He is somebody that I found to embrace in sympathy. And in ability, an enormous range of what is happening and has happened in KPFA over the years, and it was encouraging to me that after all that he went through, and I know he went through some awfully rough times along the way, that here he is still. Making his contribution and brought in for certain specific things, often high profile things, because he's a high profile person, and still able to back the place with great enthusiasm and eloquence.
That's right. Larry is. I remember when I first became manager and I wanted to delve into some history. I was about to make a decision to make everybody mad. Before I did it, I wanted to know exactly what I was doing. So I called Larry and I said, Larry, why don't you pull out material related to this topic, whatever it was, that happened while you were manager. I think it was, again, corporate underwriting. And he said, do I really have to? He says, it was one of the most painful periods of my life. And I feel like if I go open one of those boxes, it'll be like Pandora's
Pandora,
spot.
Right.
He says, so can I just answer your questions and not deal with this? I don't want to touch it.
Oh, boy.
But he's like there. He's there for it. And the organization has not always been kind to Larry.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry has capacity to understand the larger picture and to be very forgiving about the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a huge amount of respect for Larry. I think Larry has a lot of integrity and represents the best of what Pacifica, what comes out of Pacifica,
mm-hmm.
and who supports Pacifica.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think that I have observed as a general tendency over the years, so watch out, is that a director comes in, a new director of the station comes in as a representative of new advanced thinking and practice at the forefront to shake up the stodgy old practices that have been going on in the past. The new broom comes in and sweeps away all the detritus, and within a certain period of time is thrust out as an old fogey. Who doesn't understand what's going on now, because
the struggle continues.
Someone else has come along.
That's a luta continua. That's exactly what happens, and that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that everything changes over a period of time. I expect that I will be quite jaded in another 2 or 3 years, and it's time to be swept out and somebody else to come in and do something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I expect that's what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been this has been a great experience for me because, frankly, I did not volunteer in the first place to write what I did for the first 10 years.
Oh, really?
Somebody asked me to do it for that publication because I knew I'd been associated with it, and it was on America in the 1950s, and KPFA I considered to be an important part of what had happened culturally in America in the 1950s, quite rightly. So I set out to do it. Having done it, the people that I interviewed, then when they saw the final product, came back to me and started climbing all over my back to bring it up to date. They insisted, I won't indulge in false modesty, that I had done the most cogent job of tying together the threads and presenting it within a cultural context. So I decided that maybe if that's my karma, maybe that's what I've got to do. And so opportunity came for me to spend these 5 weeks over here. A lot of things came together and sort of focused and said, go to America. And so I did. But I'll tell you honestly that I came over with a certain amount of trepidation because I thought this is likely to end up being the story of a long decline, a history which will not be in any way acceptable to the present generation of people at the station,
yeah.
And will put me firmly as one of the old fogies from the first generation. But as I have been here. And talk to people, and begun to gather what has actually been going on. I am increasingly convinced that I will end up writing with a perfectly good conscience something which would be acceptable to those who are at the station at the moment. Of course, now if it's it might not be acceptable to those that are there 2 years from now because you know how these things how these things change, but I feel that I've been I've been updated in a certain way inside my own head, mm-hmm. In the process of this, and I've begun to see that one could write an infinity of histories of Pacifica from different viewpoints, which would have totally different emphases and different outcomes, but at two extremes. One of them could be a history of Pacifica as it related to the specific ideals of the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson and that is to say Lew Hill and all that sort of thing at the beginning, and one would write a sad story of decline and fall from a certain kind of a viewpoint narrowly taken. If one set out to examine Pacifica as perhaps a metaphor for the society in which it has evolved and which it has tried to express and to embody over the years, you would, from that standpoint, you would have a picture of, compared with other cultural institutions, a remarkably flexible and dynamic and flowering and expanding and growing institution that perhaps more than any other cultural institution of that kind of continuity, 40 years of history, it represents today something which is closer to what one would expect of an organization that had only been started a year or two ago.
Well, my concern about Pacifica is that if it does not really move to embody the culture that it exists in a more inclusive way, that'll be extinct at the turn of the century. And so I think that it is no longer acceptable for Pacifica stations. I think after the 70s, they became sort of private clubs for those people that were inside of it already, that had a forum for what they were interested in, whether it was cultural or political, mm-hmm. or even news. And I think that Pacifica can't afford to be that narrowly focused, that it has to move outside of itself to embrace a larger culture, which it has always done. And I think the mm-hmm. success of Pacifica is that it has been able, over periods of time, to move outside of itself and to do that. And I think the continued success of Pacifica will be to do that. Mm-hmm. And at any time that it does not move out of itself and embrace a larger culture, it'll disintegrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, there's always the very real possibility that the culture itself may be dead by the turn of the century.
Well, there will be no need for Pacifica at that point.
Well, perhaps there could come a hypothetical time at which Pacifica could become the Irish monasteries of the Dark Ages.
No way. No, because it couldn't survive. It survives. Pacifica survives with the goodwill and support of people that find it of value. Mm-hmm. And at any time the larger population doesn't find it of value, it will no longer have the money to sustain itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think of this? One of the problems of radio broadcasting as such is that we live in a time which has become increasingly accelerated in activity, and there are more and more calls on people's times, and their schedules become more and more inflexible. So anything which presents information to people in rigid time slots of whatever they are, whether they're banded, unbanded, or whatever, that in order to hear a certain thing, you have to listen at a particular time on a particular day. There looks like being a very real move in the direction of electronic accessibility to sound information on flexible schedules that would, in effect, put the programming at the precise moment you wanted to listen to it. If you wanted to hear it at 3:00.
That would be the salvation of Pacifica, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And I think that will actually happen.
I think that through some either, you know, radio, internet, some, or some analogy of it, or
I think the digital broadcasting will really bring it to us that way, where we can plug into whatever we want to plug into, whenever we want to plug into it.
Mm-hmm. People have, it's interesting that, you know, people have become accustomed to doing this with television, and virtually, you know, everybody's got a video with a timer on it, which they use.
But I don't
a
think,
lot.
Do you think people use this?
I know a lot of people who do. But I know hardly anybody at all who has a cassette machine with a timer on it, an audio cassette machine, to record a radio program that is on at an inconvenient time so that they can listen to it later.
I don't know very many people with television sets that do it either. And I think that the technology will make it so that you do not have to record it. I think you'll be able to just,
that's the point.
You know, just select it. Let's just bring it up from anything, anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that do that is terribly important is that you no longer are the victim of the 24-hour day.
That's right.
And the battle for airtime, there is an infinity of airtime. There can be as many programs as people can produce. You can have programs with the freedom of access and the lack of editorial censorship that exists on the internet waves, on print at the moment. Total freedom of access, and also the total freedom to reject, to throw away the garbage, whatever your personal garbage happens to be, you don't have to dig through so much shit to find a diamond anymore.
That's right.
Yeah. And so my feeling at this point is, and I don't think that I need to tell you, that in Marshall McLuhan terms, Pacifica has to realize that, or continually remind itself, that it is not in the radio business, it's in the information business. And that the extent to which one becomes tied exclusively to radio transmission as the means of accomplishing this, one can find oneself ending up on the shelf along with the manufacturers of buggy whips.
That is true. It's definitely true. But I think that I think Pacifica is well positioned to do any number of things under any number of scenarios. And we're looking at all of that, especially the technology and what it allows us to do and what we're looking at.
Yeah. And one of the biggest advantages you have is that you are not driven inexorably by the need to make enormous amounts of money out of it.
That's right. We need to make enough money to pay our bills and to pay staff that does the work.
Yeah, but you don't have a bunch of stockholders out there
that's not enough to
make more.
That's right. But just be able to operate individual stations, I think, of all the stations, probably KPFA is the only one that really is self-sufficient. The other four are really not.
Yeah. Well, I think there's been a combination of some good luck and some good management going on.
Well, I think that there's the community that KPFA operates in. I think there are a large number of people in the community that really support the work of KPFA. I was really kind of surprised because when we started this capital campaign, Dick is a very organized and character, and so everything had a place, and there was a way to do this and a way to do that. And so it was KPFA's 40th birthday, and we were asking people for between $25,000 and $40,000. And so the first time I went out to ask somebody for that kind of money, I simply stood in front of my mirror to shape my mouth to ask somebody for $25,000 to $40,000. I practiced it that night. And that day when we went out, you know, this is an old time lefty, and a lot of people had some kind of money, $25,000 to $40,000 worth of money. And she said, "Sure, how do you want it?" You know, and the level of support, you know, very few people that we asked for that kind of money, we knew who to ask for that kind of money, first of all, because Dick did the background work mm-hmm. and research. Yeah. But very few of those people turned us down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Elsa used to say, way back then, the trouble with this place is we ask millionaires for $20.
She was absolutely right. And sometimes, I mean, several times I asked people, you know, because what we did is we got their names from a list. Anybody that ever gave KBFA more than $100. Mm-hmm. And I would take the list, and I would go to somebody that I knew that knew people in the community, and I said, do you know any of these people? What do you know about them? You know, we would compile a list like that. And several people, I said, you know, you've never given us more than $100. So I want to ask you why you gave us $25,000. Because you never asked for more than $100. And most of the time, you didn't even ask for that. You know, so it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the people in this community really, mm-hmm. and for different reasons. You mm-hmm. know, you can't be everything to everybody, but, you know, there's some people that liked the new music programs. There were some people that liked the drama and literature programs. Mm-hmm. You know, and they didn't have inherited wealth, but a lot of people were in their 70s and 80s. And they said, you know, here. You know, and particularly a lot of people of color, which I was surprised about, especially in Berkeley, that didn't have money, but would call and say, you know, I'm like this fellow, Ray Thompson, who's like been around Berkeley for ages and ages and ages. He was on the co-op board for a long time. And Ray called me one day and he said, you know, his wife Jackie had died about 6 months earlier. And he says, you know, I really don't have any reason to live anymore. He says, I'm thinking about checking out. He says, so I just want you to tell me. He was a real curmudgeon kind of character. He says, I want you to tell me in 3 to 5 sentences why I should leave KPFA my money. And he left KPFA a large sum of money. He died about 2 or 3 months after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there were a lot of people like that around.
My archetypal vision of the KPFA fund drive for years was a hippie sitting out on the street with a cup and a sign reading, "We'll talk for food."
It's not quite like that. It's not quite like that.
That is a deliberate caricature.
But you know the hippie era, we've touched on the hippie era several times since we've been talking. That was only a very brief time mm-hmm. in Pacific in KPFA's mm-hmm. history. You know, where, you know, it went from academic and intellectual mm-hmm. to embracing people from the free speech movement. It was right in the middle of the whole free mm-hmm. speech movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To, you know, being a multicultural organization and having a third world department and a news bureau in East Oakland and you name it,
mm-hmm.
To being now sort of a lot of different things. And it really has to find a direction, you know, how to be inclusive and also focused and to really define who an audience is, you know, mm-hmm. who, in order to function in this century, in this decade, in the next decade or two. KPFA has to really decide very seriously who their audience is. Who do they want to be their audience? It can't be everybody. You know, it really can't mm-hmm. be everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's going to be a real hard decision for this organization to make.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm interested in echoes that I hear of the past from people who don't realize that they are echoing the past, yeah. For instance, at the very beginning, as you well know, the idea of programming on KPFA was that it should represent the broadest possible spectrum of opinion from the far left to the far right, behave as if KPFA were the only information source that anybody had. Mm-hmm. And so having an equal, an equal responsibility to present everything to these tabula rasa people out there who needed to have it all in order to the noble sentiments of Milton's Areopagitica that error will be defeated when reason is left free to combat it, it's a nice idea and as function. But then, one hears now very strongly stated that the idea of that the reason for KPFA is to present the positions, the viewpoints, the feelings of those who do not have access to the other media. But this was expressed equally forcefully as long ago as 1960 by Harold Winkler. Mm-hmm. Who wrote just exactly that in mm-hmm. one of his statements at the time of a senatorial investigation, and he stated it as forcibly, although he stated it in elegant language, but he stated it as forcibly as anybody could
Apparently.
Say it.
Right. Well, I think that we've lost our way in a certain respect. Because what we do now is we don't behave as if we are the only ones and we're presenting the full range of opinions here from this perspective. Mm-hmm. I think at a certain point, KPFA really moved into presenting only the progressive and liberal so-called point of view. And in doing so, ended up preaching that. Mm-hmm. And as an ex-Catholic, I don't have a lot of appreciation for it.
Mm-hmm. Jesuitically trained by
yes.
age. Right on.
So here we are. I believe that we should present a full range of opinions. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we need to give a lot of time mm-hmm. to it. I don't want to provide a forum for the so-called right wing. Mm-hmm. But I think that you cannot present a so-called progressive point of view without presenting that point of view that isn't. Mm-hmm. And I think you mm-hmm. and I think that we owe it to people and their intelligence to give it to them and let them make their own mm-hmm. decisions about it without yeah. saying, hey, here's the deal. This is what's mm-hmm. happening.
Yeah. Well, Larry this morning cited an example of a program that he had done which sounded to me like a wonderful idea called The Cops. He said in which he had representatives of the local police force in on the air, taking phone calls.
Yeah, fabulous. But you know when?
But
when
he did it. He said.
Yeah, well, I didn't hear him do that. I would have been great. Mm-hmm. Elsa got into a lot of trouble when she wanted to have the Klan on, and people marched around the Pacifica offices, KPFA offices on Shattuck, because they were opposed to her even interviewing them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that that was sort of the beginning. Mm-hmm. Of when people were becoming so myopic mm-hmm. that they couldn't do that.
One of the most elegant programs that I ever heard on KPFA was Byron Bryant, who was a magnificent figure on the air, just fabulous, in which he had a very straight, noncommittal, objective interview with Rockwell of the American Nazi Party.
Yeah.
And treated him as if he were the President of the United States.
That's exactly right.
And allowed him to hang himself at will.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a more middle-of-the-road kind of issue, not really middle-of-the-road, but something that I think that Pacifica, KPFA, did very well in recent history were the discussions around NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement. Mm-hmm. There mm-hmm. was considerable support opposition to NAFTA mm-hmm. within the staff at this station. Mm-hmm. But to their credit, they gave airtime and had dialogue and debate on that issue. But only because there is a considerable influence of people of color in the station that were pro-NAFTA.
We're pro.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so you got both sides of the issue. You know, you really got both sides of the issue, the pro and the con, regardless of where one stood on it. And most people politically were against it. But what came off over the air was a real reasoned mm-hmm. dialogue mm-hmm. on the issue, which I was very heartened by, quite frankly.
I'll tell you another theory that I arrived at last night in a blinding flash of light in a long conversation with Scott Keach, an old friend that I worked with many years ago and was very happy to be reunited with. And as we were talking about ELSA in the early days of KPFA, I suddenly realized something. Now, the things that ELSA was accused of over and over and over again were arrogance, the fact that she did not suffer fools gladly, that she had a brain that worked like a rapier, and that anybody who entered into argument with her was likely to find themselves in small pieces on the floor before they even realized that the knife had entered. That she was devoted to professional values that sometimes at the expense of everything else. That she had a platform a system of a philosophical and a moral system, which was the foundation of what she did. Accusations along those lines of arrogance, loftiness, high-handedness. Every one of those accusations was entered against Lou Hill at the beginning. Sure. Everybody described him in exactly those terms.
Is that right?
But the big difference was, and I think it was really the significant difference, Lou Hill was a man, Elsa Knight Thompson was a woman. And I think that if the whole structure, the social structure of America had been different in those early days when Elsa was in the station, Elsa would have been able to take the one job that she was always denied that she could have fulfilled and that would have smoothed all sorts of things, namely station manager.
I just never even thought of Elsa in those terms. I've never met her. And, mm-hmm. But those things that you described are the descriptions that I've heard from those people
mm-hmm.
that do,
yeah.
including Ray Thompson, the man that I mentioned mm-hmm. to you earlier, who called up and said he was about to check out. Mm-hmm. He was extremely fond of Elsa Knight Thompson.
Mm-hmm. She was a great lady. She was a great person.
Right.
I worked under her for years. I learned under her. A whole generation of some of the best media people in America. All over, learned under her.
But people were not kind to Lou Hill either.
No, they were. Lou, people don't want to talk about it anymore. He resigned several times within a matter of a relatively short period of time, because. Have you had a chance to read that little thing of mine that I wrote? I suggest that you do. It's not very long. I think you'll find it very interesting.
Okay.
Along, and I only wish that I had had this particular insight when I wrote that. But never mind, I've got it now when it's coming up, because I think that this contrast, both contrast and likeness, between Lou Hill and Elsa, is a route into. The influence of gender prejudice on the station in those early days, because Elsa was a woman, but there were long times when she was the only person in the station that had balls, and she could have been if things had permitted, if the society, if the times had permitted it, she could have been a terrific station manager.
Yeah.
And she would not then have been the deposed monarch, with all of the neuroses and the frustrations and the bitterness that goes along with that.
Yeah, it's a hard number sometimes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. If you had been back there in Elsa's spot, you'd be a witch.
Oh, I'm a witch anyway.
Ha ha ha.